Thanks.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter. This program is designed for English learners. So we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today you will hear Brian Lynn tell about an experimental method for launching satellites in our science report. Then you will hear our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, this story from Anna Mateo.
A theater in Hungary's capital is likely to go unused through a cold and quiet winter. Theater operators have decided to close buildings rather than pay high prices for heating and electricity. High energy costs are making it hard for many businesses and cultural institutions across Europe to stay open. The 111-year-old Erkel Theater in Budapest is one of three performance spaces of the Hungarian State Opera that will close in November. The operators can no longer pay to heat the 1,800-seat building. "We had to decide how we can save," said Sylvester Okovac, the director of the Hungarian State Opera. "Even though it hurts to close Erkel for a few months," he said, "it makes sense." He added that people's pay is the most important. The group's energy bills have become 8 times and sometimes 10 times more costly than usual. The temporary closure of the Erkel Theater is one of many cases involving cultural institutions in Hungary. Many are struggling to stay open. High inflation, a weakening currency, and energy costs are hurting many businesses and groups. This situation is taking place across Europe as energy prices skyrocket or greatly increase because of Russia's war in Ukraine. High energy costs are forcing some factories to shut down, making products more costly and fueling fears of a recession. In July, Hungary's government declared an energy emergency. It was a reaction to rising prices and supply problems linked to Russia's war in Ukraine. The government also reduced a popular utility payment aid program. Since 2014, that program has kept Hungarians' cost for energy and water among the lowest in the 27-member European Union. As a result, many businesses and households saw natural gas and electric bills increase by as much as 1,000% from 1 month to the next. In an effort to save energy, Hungary's government ordered a 25% reduction in the use of electricity and natural gas in public buildings. This includes cultural institutions, such as museums and theaters. Now they are required to keep temperatures inside buildings at or below 18 degrees Celsius. Beata Barda is director of the Trafo House of Contemporary Arts in Budapest. She said her theater's electricity bills have risen 200% since June. Barda added that there is an uncertainty factor. That means she does not know how big her gas and electric bills are going to be this winter. To cut costs, the theater will show about two-thirds of its normal winter program. Also, parts of the building that do not need to be heated will be shut off from the rest. And the number of rehearsals that need full stage lighting will be cut down. Barda said, "We'd like to avoid shutting down or having to cancel performances. So obviously, we've got to cut down in all sorts of ways." In Hungary, inflation is at nearly 16%. The national currency is reaching historic lows against the dollar and euro. People are also struggling with rising prices. Barda said, "Few people could go to the theater. This could lead to financial troubles for the entire cultural industry. Our audiences have wallets too, and their expenses have also risen," Barda said. "How able or willing will they be to come to the theater? This is a really important question." The Comedy Theater of Budapest is one of the oldest in the city. The lights in the building's entrance area and long hallways have been shut off, even on working days, to save energy. The gas bill for the large theater has gone from $92,000 a year to $577,000. Local governments around the country have announced that theaters, museums, and other cultural centers must close for the winter. As the energy crisis deepens, more of Hungary's cultural centers could be threatened with closure. Krisztina Szerke is a stage director in Budapest. She said closures would be very bad for the cultural life of Hungarians. She said she believes that if these institutions fail or are unavailable, it could affect the mental state of the entire society. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you, Anna. Next is our science report from Brian Lynn.
An American company has carried out tests of a system that uses a high-speed spinning machine to launch satellites into space. The machine, which is powered by kinetic energy, is meant to greatly reduce costs and fuel required for traditional rocket launches. The California-based company that developed the system is called SpinLaunch. It announced its recent test launch last week. The launch took place on September 27th at Spaceport America, a private space launch complex in the western state of New Mexico. The company said the tests involved payloads from several organizations, including the American Space Agency, NASA. In a statement, SpinLaunch said all payloads tested were flown and recovered successfully. It did not provide details on what the payloads contained. SpinLaunch said the September tests included the 10th carried out since October 2021. It added that testing was observed by more than 150 partners, government officials, and industry advocates. NASA signed an agreement with Spin Launch earlier this year to develop and test a payload launch using the company's system. The agreement was signed as part of NASA's Flight Opportunities Program. The program provides the chance for private companies to work together with NASA to test new technologies the space agency might use in its future space operations. NASA is examining the possibility of partnering with Spin Launch to deploy future payloads using the company's launch technology. Spin Launch said NASA cooperated with its team after the latest tests to capture critical launch characteristics of Spin Launch's kinetic launch system. Spin Launch's suborbital accelerator used in the tests is a 33-meter steel structure with an electrically powered spinning arm. A rocket is placed inside the accelerator. The system's high-speed turning motion produces kinetic energy designed to spin the rocket at speeds of more than 5 times the speed of sound. The suborbital accelerator is built to propel the rocket to near-Earth orbit. This is generally considered to be at an altitude of about 2,000 kilometers above Earth's surface. Spin Launch has plans to keep expanding its technology and equipment to be able to send space objects into higher orbit. The company says most satellites can handle the high spinning speeds, although some will require special modifications to work with the system. With the suborbital accelerator, a separate propulsion system would be necessary for satellites to reach higher orbits. Spin Launch officials said tests of the system have resulted in the flight vehicles being recovered and that the rockets can be reused. Jonathan Yaney is the founder and chief executive of Spin Launch. He said in a statement that the latest flight tests will be invaluable for space launch engineers as well as the company's partners. He added that the company will continue working to further develop the system to provide a low-cost and sustainable way to deploy satellites to space. Yaney said the Spin Launch system and the way it operates is much less complex than traditional rocket launching systems. This greatly cuts launch costs for large organizations and small companies alike. In addition, the lack of fuel needed to send objects into near-Earth orbit represents a much more environmentally friendly system. The technology is being tested as the demand for satellite deployments continues to grow. Market research company iMark Group recently reported the worldwide small satellite market reached $3.68 billion in 2021. The group projects the market will rise to $8.84 billion by 2027. I'm Brian Lin.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
And now, our American History series.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but, as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a secretary of state who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a secretary of the treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a secretary of war who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Ferling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Ferling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas. And he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America.